hindsight, blah, 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 but second's pretty good.
Better than scratching.
The wild finish to this year's Iditarod. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a Sitka family logs onto healthcare.gov and cuts their healthcare premium bill in half.
You know, sometimes I felt like I couldn't afford to go to the doctor because I had to pay my health insurance bills.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
There's a good feeling you get when you give, and each year more Alaskans are supporting things they love when they file online for their PFD. Alaskans like you donated $2.5 million last year to strengthen education, help families in need of food and shelter, and protect the most vulnerable among us. You even shared your permanent fund dividends with public radio to keep quality programming alive and well. This year, the PFD is expected to be a lot bigger. So come on, love Alaska. Pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Dallas Seavey won this year's Iditarod early this morning in a surprise victory, just a few minutes ahead of front of runner-up Allie Zirkel. The top six mushers have now reached the finish line in Nome. The 42nd annual Iditarod has proven to be one of the most dramatic from start to finish. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, the trail from Anchorage to Nome threw everything possible at mushers, from rocks to tree stumps to hurricane-force winds.
Before he left White Mountain, Jeff King was confident he'd set his team up for a solid fifth championship.
My team charges these checkpoints with more reckless abandon than it seems many other teams do. No matter how tired they are, they dig deep and just have to make me step on the brake to come in.
If King's team had been able to hold out against hurricane force winds blowing off Norton Sound, he would have become only the second musher to win the Iditarod five times. The 58-year-old would have also become the oldest musher to win and in record time, but it was not to be. The team was blown into a pile of driftwood roughly 4 miles out of the safety checkpoint. King spent more than 2 hours trying to untangle his dogs, but they shut down and he had to ask someone on a snow machine for help. It's a story this year's second place finisher, Allie Zirkel, relayed to winner Dallas Seavey during a post-race press conference.
So I got to safety and the sheet was blank. And I said, where's Jeff? They said, you didn't see him? So we were all highly concerned about all the teams, and then, so I had two dogs I was really worried about, and myself, to be honest. So I said, to heck with it, I'm staying. Dad? And then some snow machiners came in, and by golly, if they didn't have Jeff on the back of the snow machine.
As CV fought his way through stiff winds towards Nome, he had no idea what was happening to the competition in front. He didn't know King was out, and he had no idea Zirkel was struggling to rework her race plan inside the safety shelter cabin.
It was really, really bad out there, and it was the safest thing for me to do, just to get my act together and not leave. And then I took a nap, had some coffee. What else did I do? Listen to people talk about how bad it was outside. And then I saw you go through.
When CV spotted a headlamp behind him, he assumed it belonged to his father, Mitch. He thought he was racing for third place. He came sprinting down Front Street in the wee hours of the morning, red-faced and panting. He collapsed on the back of his sled, where he sat for a few minutes after his dogs crossed the line. It's the second time the younger Seavey has beat out Zirkel for the top spot. It's also the third consecutive year Zirkel has finished behind a Seavey in second place. Dallas's father took the win last year. Zirkel was visibly disappointed, but she says it's not the worst that could have happened.
Sure, yeah, hindsight, blah, 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 but second's pretty good.
Better than scratching.
Clearly the favorite in this year's race, the crowd chanted her name even after she arrived in Nome. She says that kind of support is humbling.
Yeah, over the last 8 days, I've really run into a lot of people who are just really
I've brought them down the trail with me in my heart, and it's very motivating.
Just over 3 hours after he claimed his second Iditarod championship, the younger CV waited for his father to finish the race in third place. The two hugged, but Mitch CV had no idea his son had won.
I thought it was you, and I crossed, and I guess I won. So we went 1-3, nicely done.
That's unbelievable.
Did you hold up? You all right?
I'm still standing.
Well, that's all you can hope for at this stage.
That was ridiculous.
The elder CV came into Nome clearly exhausted and completely bewildered.
We crashed and tipped and whatever, you know, countless times.
The wind is still blowing wildly out along the coast of the Bering Sea. Teams are fighting to travel over thick, uneven glare ice without getting too close to the open ocean. The drama that ensued for the first few mushers may not be the last in Iditarod 42 as teams continue to make their way for the finish line. On the Iditarod Trail, I'm Emily Schwing in Nome.
Today, the State House Community and Regional Affairs Committee heard from several people about the sorry state of law and order for Alaska Natives. Legislators asked them why they think the state is the source of the problem, but the person in the best position to answer that question couldn't make it to the hearing. The Attorney General had a scheduling conflict. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes reports.
The chairman of the Indian Law and Order Commission, Troy Ide, says the commission studied issues for Native Americans across the country, but in a recent report singled out Alaska because of the level of violence Alaska Natives experience.
We're talking about a state where victims of domestic violence are suffering those assaults at roughly 10 times the national average. And by some indications, sexual assaults are roughly 12 times the national average. You have the highest suicide rate, not just in the United States, but one of the very highest in the entire Western Hemisphere among Alaska Natives.
Ide says the commissioners brought different perspectives to the report, but unanimously agreed the problem is Alaska's outdated, centralized approach.
But I can tell you emphatically that all nine of us, Republicans and Democrats, Native and non-Native, men and women, we all think Alaska is on the wrong track. You cannot continue to have this centralized state system and support it in the manner in which it's been supported and expect anything other than disproportionately high rates of violent crime and a very wasteful system that, frankly, as taxpayers, is just not acceptable.
Ide says the state is not just headed in the wrong direction, it's antagonistic to tribes.
It's in every Alaskan's interest to save that kind of money and to not have an environment where you spend more money litigating against your natives than all the other states in the United States combined.
Unlike tribes in the lower 48, which for the most part were formed through treaties, Alaska tribes were formed under a process created by the Indian Reorganization Act of 1935. Then the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971 transferred title to traditional homelands to for-profit corporations, not tribes. When committee members asked how villages could exercise jurisdiction when they don't own land, Ide said tribal sovereignty is not land-based. He suggested the state set aside land disputes and work with tribes to create a system that allows for problem-solving at the local level.
Much as if you were drawing a line for a borough or for a city or a township or a municipality, you'd just draw a government line. You wouldn't necessarily worry about who owned the specific land. You would say, here's a line that makes sense for self-government. And all I'm suggesting is that you could do the same thing with your Native nations. You could find a way to make this a more locally based system without having to solve every fight over land.
Michelle DeWitt of Bethel says she's worked in the field of domestic violence for 20 years. When asked why she thinks the state so strongly opposes tribal sovereignty, she said it's dug in, defending a broken system.
The state spends significant resources defending issues around land, and then that impacts social policy, and it impacts the ability to move forward on other platforms.
People also testified local law enforcement and judges are starved for resources, saying most tribal judges are unpaid or receive only part-time pay, Village Public Safety Officer James Holscher of Hooper Bay says he has a car, office, and housing, three essentials he says many VPSOs are not provided.
If you sat down and you listened to the majority of VPSOs, I think most of us would be surprised to hear what they are not offered or what is not provided to them. That is essential for them being in their communities to work.
Holscher says domestic violence, search and rescue, fires, and gun incidents would be more manageable and less worrisome if he had backup closer to Hooper Bay.
They meet the best conditions. Even with that, the response time can be hours. And that's something that weighs heavy on my mind, and I know it weighs heavy on a lot of VPSOs' minds, that they may be alone in a situation where nobody should be alone in.
Community and Regional Affairs Committee co-chair Ben Nyack wrapped up the hearing, saying the committee will extend another invitation to the Attorney General and to other agency representatives to tell their side of the story. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Senate Resources is expected to be the only Senate committee to consider a sweeping bill that proposes changes to Alaska's permitting system. A revamped version of HB 77 emerged in Senate Resources on Monday. Public testimony is scheduled for tomorrow. The bill currently has no other committee of referral. If the bill advances from Resources, Senate Majority Leader John Coghill said the intent is to send it to Rules, which schedules bills for the floor. HB 77 last year was stuck in Senate Rules after failing to win sufficient support in the Senate for a vote. The bill is expansive, touching on issues like land exchanges and permitting procedures. Its more contentious provisions have focused on appeals, general permits, and the issuance of water reservations. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a popular ice cave under the Mendenhall Glacier that's potentially dangerous.
I just didn't feel like taking my five-year-old daughter back through there and feeling like something could fall down on us.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The government's top archivist, David Ferriero, announced today the Anchorage branch of the National Archives will close this year. Its collection will be shipped to Seattle, where he says it will be digitized and made available to historians and researchers on the Internet. The closure of the Third Avenue facility, along with consolidations in Philadelphia and Fort Worth, are projected to save more than $1 million per year. The National Archives also owns a 9-acre lot in Midtown Anchorage, purchased a decade ago with the sponsorship of then-Senator Ted Stevens. Senator Lisa Murkowski suggested today archives should use money from the sale of that land to more quickly put the Alaska collection online. She also asked the National Archivist to consider affiliating with an Alaska library so the documents could stay in state. New figures from the Obama administration show more than 6,500 Alaskans have enrolled in insurance plans on healthcare.gov. The deadline to sign up is March 31st, and that has prompted many Alaskans to bite the bullet and figure out what the Affordable Care Act means for them. As Rachel Waldholtz reports from Sitka, for some commercial fishermen and others who are self-employed, what they found has been a pleasant surprise.
Back in 2012, when the Supreme Court upheld most of President Obama's signature health care law, Wendy Alderson hoped the ruling would mean good things for her family.
I know what I would hope that it would do for us, and I hope that it would basically just bring down the cost of our health insurance.
That was an interview Alderson did with KCAW in June 2012, right after the Supreme Court decision cleared the way for the Affordable Care Act to go into effect. Alderson and her husband are commercial fishermen. They own their own boat, a combination freezer troller and longliner. And for the past decade, they bought a very basic health insurance plan. They paid over $12,000 a year to cover Alderson, her husband, and their daughter. The plan had a deductible of about $2,500 per individual, meaning that's how much they'd have to pay before the insurance kicked in.
You know, sometimes I felt like I couldn't afford to go to the doctor because I had to pay my health insurance bills.
So now that the Affordable Care Act is actually going into effect, we checked back to see if it was living up to her expectations. And at first, Alderson actually didn't think the act would do much for her family. In fact, she wouldn't even have looked for a new plan, but her current insurance costs suddenly increased from about $1,100 a month to $1,400 a month, or $15,000 a year, just for catastrophic insurance.
I decided I better get on the stick and take a look at what was available.
So she logged into healthcare.gov, the new online health insurance exchange. And were you surprised when you
realized? Oh, I was astounded.
Her new plan will cost about half as much as her old one.
Honestly, too good to be true thing for me. It's like, wow, really?
The new plan is actually quite similar to her old plan, but instead of paying $1,400 per month, she'll pay just $680. In total, it will cost $7,000 this year instead of $15,000. That's because Alderson's family qualifies for a tax credit. Families that make up to four times the federal poverty level can qualify for tax credits and subsidies that cover part of the cost of health insurance bought on the exchange. So in Alaska, a family of three making up to about $98,000 can be eligible. Still, Alderson said the new system isn't ideal.
The plan still costs the same. It's the government subsidizing those of us who qualify. And so I do understand that now, and that's a little bit of a bummer.
Sitka resident Dan Evans is also self-employed.
I am a photographer, and I am a home inspector as well.
Evans hasn't had health insurance for most of the past 5 or 6 years. For the past 3 years, he tried to enroll in insurance, but he was denied because of pre-existing conditions. He finally got insurance this past December. He paid $400 a month for a catastrophic plan with a $10,000 deductible.
Really, the only time you'd ever use it is if you really got hurt or sick real bad.
The issue of health insurance weighed so heavily on his mind that he was considering giving up his photography business.
I've been self-employed for like 25, 30 years now, and I actually started kind of looking for jobs that could give me insurance, even though I don't want them. But I just feel, I see a lot of my friends and other people when they're getting up there, things happen. And I just kept thinking that I was kind of, something might happen to me and I could have everything taken away.
Search outreach manager Andrea Thomas has been helping people navigate the website. She worked with Evans to find a plan that will cost him just $189 a month. The deductible is $1,500.
I actually said to Andrea, I said, Andrea, you got to stand up right now. I got to give you a hug because this is unbelievable. She knew I was really happy.
As for Wendy Alderson, we asked what her family will do with the money they're no longer spending on health insurance.
Pay bills. Nothing glamorous, sadly. You know, it'll be nice to just know that I don't have to struggle to come up with money to, you know, pay bills.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Rachel Waldholtz.
Alaska's legislature is still searching for ways to connect King Cove and Cold Bay by building a road through a federal wildlife refuge. Their latest effort is a joint resolution introduced by Aleutians Representative Bob Heron. The 6-page resolution urges Interior Secretary Sally Jewell to reconsider a land swap plan she turned down in December. The state of Alaska and the King Cove Corporation are still offering 61,000 acres of land. In return, they want 1,800 acres in and around the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. King Cove would build a gravel road through that parcel to the town of Cold Bay, where more reliable commercial medevacs are available. That's one reason why Heron calls the rejection of the land deal heartless and cold in his resolution. It advanced during a hearing in Alaska's House Resources Committee yesterday. Senator Lisa Murkowski called in from Washington to offer praise.
I think this resolution will help affirm that as Alaskans, we are united in opposition to the Secretary's decision, and that we're united in our desire to protect the health and safety of those who live in King Cove.
Murkowski criticized the Interior Department's approach on multiple occasions. Yesterday, she reminded the Alaska House Resources Committee that Interior Secretary Jewell pledged to find a different solution when she rejected the road almost 3 months ago.
But there has been no idea, no proposal transmitted thus far Not one employee that I can find at Interior has done anything to improve the situation. And each day that passes, the people of King Cove are further put at risk because of a decision that our own federal government has made.
Jewel based her ruling on testimony, studies, and site visits by Interior staff, including her own trip last summer. Jewel said the road would do irreversible damage to the land and wildlife in the Eisenbeck Refuge.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD. Paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov or on Facebook. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Juneau's most popular attraction is Mendenhall Glacier, one of the most accessible in the world. Visitors and residents took advantage of the recent cold, clear weather to hike across a frozen lake in front of the glacier to find an ice cave. They've taken pictures of themselves inside the tunnel, surrounded by blue-tinted ice walls. But as KTOO's Matt Miller wonders how safe it is.
Lori Craig at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center has this advice for people embarking on the mile-and-a-half hike on Mendenhall Lake out to the cave.
Just for people to be really cautious, be safe, be prepared.
The ice cave is located near the western terminus of Mendenhall Glacier. While the Forest Service is not encouraging people to visit the cave, it's not prohibiting access either. Jason Amundsen is Associate Professor of Geophysics at the University of Alaska Southeast and has researched tidewater glaciers and glacier-ocean interactions. He says the cave was likely formed by a stream coming down off of nearby Mount McGinnis.
The water is carrying heat with it, and that heat goes to melting the ice. And then I guess as it's gotten bigger in the summer, there's water running into that ice cave, but there's also warm air that can make its way into the ice beneath the glacier.
Another stream on the glacier surface found a fissure or a crack and over time created the giant circular shaft or moulin that allows daylight into the far accessible end of the cave.
A fairly common feature on glaciers, you get water running over the surface of a glacier and it drops into a crevasse. Basically, because the water is more dense than ice, it wants to move downward, and so it basically drills a hole through the glacier. And so that's probably just something that formed at the surface. Could have been there for a long time, and maybe it's just now, as the glacier has moved down valley, it's now just right in the same spot as where the ice cave is.
Amundsen says different layers of the glacier may flow at different rates. Same for the center versus the edges, where friction with the ground and surrounding hills can slow the ice movement. UAS Environmental Science Associate Professor Aaron Hood believes the ice in that area may be over 200 years old.
You can see in the walls there's a lot of subglacial sediment that's been entrained, and so some areas the ice looks actually quite dark because there's a lot of sediment in there, which is the glacier's just picked up.
Visitors to the glacier can be deceived by the apparent stillness and sublime beauty of the area. The Mendenhall calves all the time, even in the winter. Lori Craig says the 5-story high, snow-covered blocks of blue ice near the western edge broke off about a week ago. Calving events can cause lake ice to undulate or even shatter over large areas.
Someone who was skiing on the lake when that happened on Thursday afternoon, and he said he could feel the ripple as it rolled across the lake.
While the interior of the ice cave is essentially on land and several dozen feet under the glacier, the overhead ice at the entrance may only be several feet or even a few inches thick. Aaron Hood says he escorted a photographer to the back of the cave 2 years ago, but he won't take his child there.
The one dangerous place, in my view anyway, is near the entrance to the cave, where you have some overhanging ice that's pretty thin, and you could actually have blocks breaking off there. And I just didn't feel like taking my 5-year-old daughter back through there and feeling like something could fall down on us.
Hood says deep inside the cave is relatively solid, but there is always a risk of collapse. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
At this year's ceremonial start of the Iditarod in Anchorage, Rod Perry drove a sled that weighed more than twice as much as the others. The Iditarod Pioneer hopes it was the first of many historic runs to come. APRN intern Jolene Almendrez has the story.
Rod Perry has dedicated much of his life to preserving Iditarod history. From storytelling to keeping tabs on up-and-coming mushers and technology, he could be considered an expert in all things Iditarod-related. But he says most people's understanding of the race's origin is practically nil. He imagines a ceremonial start to the race where people wearing period costumes and driving old-style sleds will kick off the Iditarod. The sled he rode in front of this year's racers is the first creation from his idea and almost an exact replica of one of the large mail-carrying sleds of the early 1900s that transported mail to and from Iditarod and Nome.
That sled, where the modern sleds weigh probably 35 or 40 pounds at the most, carrying very little, that sled weighs 240 pounds. It's about 17 feet long, built of Indiana bending oak. It's representative of a lot of the sleds that were used in the old days.
The process of making the sled using traditional techniques was not an easy one, though. But with funding from Wells Fargo Bank, Perry was able to set to work earlier this year, building the first piece from his vision. It took him nearly 5 months.
This sled, it has a toboggan bottom underneath the cross pieces of the sled. The sled is not nailed. There certainly are places where there are nails and bolts, but not in the working joints. The working joints are mortise and tenon. You have to have a kind of an engineered sloppiness built in. This sled has to flex like crazy or it would break up.
Perry's sled is on display at the Alaska Heritage Museum inside the Wells Fargo Bank on Northern Lights and C Street throughout March. Perry says it's a rare opportunity to see a lost art.
This is old-time craftsmanship. There are very few people left who know this dying art. It would be like trying to find somebody that knows how to build a stagecoach.
In Anchorage, I'm Jolene Almendarez.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing in Nome, Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Rachel Waldholtz in Sitka, and Matt Miller in Juneau. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C., and APRN intern Jolene Almendarez reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The University of Alaska Southeast offers degree programs you won't find anywhere else, like the customizable BLA, online or on campus. Information at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
Subsistence is a significant part of the lives of many Alaskans. If it's important to you, consider applying for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide information and recommendations to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. The deadline to apply is Friday, March 21st. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.